Hey, everyone. It's time for us to gather again for our third session, which is also on research methods. I'm Emmeline Oti from the National Institute of Mental Health, and I'm going to be introducing our speakers for this session. And I'm going to do it very briefly to save as much time as possible for our speakers. Our first speaker is Dr. Maggie Alegria, who is Director of the Center for Multicultural Mental Health Research at Cambridge Health Alliance and Professor of Psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Alegria's published work focuses on methods to improve health, to improve service delivery for diverse racial and ethnic populations, conceptual and methodological issues with multicultural populations, and strategies for bringing the community perspective into the design and implementation of health services. And Dr. Alegria currently has is principal investigator of three research grants from the National Institute of Mental Health. And she has received a number of awards and recognition for her work, the most recent in August of this year from a citation from the American Psychological Association for her work on health disparities.
Well, good morning to everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation. I really enjoy being here. I want to thank the organizers for having me here, I mean, especially in this incredible group of people presenting. I want to first acknowledge that this is a team effort. Julia Lynn is here in the room, Sherry Lepatan, Ora Nakash, Nick Carson, Sharon Lee Norman. And this is part of a really study that we call the Patient-Provider Encounter Study. I'm going to be talking today about, you know, why we think this is a really important issue. Let me start by saying the unequal treatment report really brought over the issue that, you know, in the IOM, if you think about it, there was the issue of stereotyping, biases, and uncertainty of the part of healthcare workers. And if you think this was quite amazing because the IOM report brought over this paradox. How could well-meaning and highly educated health professionals, which are typical people that are very interested in helping others, working under their usual circumstances with diverse populations of patients, create a pattern of care that appears to be discriminatory? So one of the things we were very interested is really looking at this issue that previous studies had noted, that there existed diagnostic bias. And what we mean by diagnostic bias is that providers make systematic errors in collection of information and in the processing of clinical information that might lead to either false positives or false negatives and misdiagnosis. And we have seen this, you know, for example, in psychotic disorders for African Americans, overdiagnosis for depression for Latinos, but still people had a hard time figuring out what's going on. And we also know that if we could reduce diagnostic bias, we would be, this would be one of the mechanisms that we could actually deal forward in terms of reducing disparities. One of the things we found early on in the literature is the literature really talks about that it's not only the information one collects in diagnostic assessment, but actually how one applies that information in decision making. So it's both the collection, what information you decide to collect, but also how you apply it in terms of diagnostic bias. And then there's been a ton of work, I cannot tell you how much work there has been since the 1950s, saying that if you use actuarial methods, and actuarial methods are very similar to symptom checklists, you actually reduce diagnostic bias by a ton. So if you actually use a symptom checklist by itself, you could actually reduce this. But yet, over and over and over again, the literature shows clinicians resist to use symptom checklists. So one of the really, I think, interesting issues in terms of theory is, well, one of the issues that people talk about is there's a lot of missing information in how clinicians get to deciding on a case, on whether the case has diagnosis of depression or diagnosis of anxiety. So they have to deal with missing information. And there's the great work of Anderson and Chin that talks about relational self. And I'll talk very briefly about this because I don't have enough time. I thought I had 30 minutes like Tom Levist. So I'm just going to zoom through it. But basically, Anderson and Chin talk about how people actually really focus when they see someone else on issues that are significant to them as in their relational self. And I'll explain this in your, hopefully you'll ask me questions and I can explain this a lot more thoroughly. But the idea is that when a patient, when a provider encounters a new patient, they actually do not focus on neutrality. They actually are going to focus on certain things that are meaningful to them as a person. The goal of the study of the patient-provider study, this is a study that is funded by the National Institute of Mental Health under an Advanced Disparity Center, was really to see how could we help clinicians that work in public psychiatric settings decrease diagnostic bias. How can we help them diagnose more accurately patients from diverse backgrounds? And finally, how could we improve the matching of clinical services to the treatment that these patients wanted? One very unusual thing about this study is that this study really wanted to go behind the scenes and study clinicians in their usual settings, under their natural conditions, without any change whatsoever in what they actually did. So everything I'm going to be presenting are naturalistic settings of clinical practice where patients and providers meet for an intake session. The other interesting thing is that very few people have really tried to figure out with clinicians how come this is happening and how could we improve upon it. A lot of the people have, you know, recommendations, but they're here, and clinicians have a very different viewpoint of what's going on. And finally, there's really a lack of comprehensive understanding of how these issues about ethnicity, race, really play into the diagnostic assessment. And so that's what we wanted to do. The study, the way we thought about it, is a clinician has to be a really good anthropologist because he has to collect all of this information from the patient, actually integrate it, and then try to figure out what's going on. And second, they also have to be a good statistician. To actually collect this information, what we actually did is we did videotapes of patients and providers in intake sessions, and then we actually, after the intake session, two separate research interviewers interview separately the provider and interview separately the patient about what happened during the actual intake interview. And based on that, we did qualitative assessments of these transcripts. The other thing we were very interested in was in trying to figure out what information about patients clinicians use as part of the statistical processing to come up to a diagnosis, and then what information they do not use that is available to them. Because I think it's as important to find out what people are using as what information are they ignoring when they decide to give a diagnosis. Just very quickly, this is 129 patient-provider diets. We had videotapes of between the patients and the providers. 47 providers participated from 8 safety net clinics around the Northeast. 47% of patients were Latino, 11% were Black, and 40% were white. The post-diagnostic interviews, as I said, were done with patients and providers. And also, we actually administer survey information, both demographic, AUDADES, which is actually a diagnostic measure. And we also collected information trying to figure out who got engaged in care, who decided after that intake session to stay in care, and who actually remained in care with that provider. So with that information, it's all information we have. The other thing I want to very quickly talk about, we actually had, because we had the videotapes, we had a separate clinician look at the interview and based on that videotape get a diagnosis of the patient, a separate diagnosis, blind to what the first clinician that had seen the patient actually did. We also collected, we had coders that actually went through every little videotape and collected every single piece of information that the person exchanged. So they collected the symptoms that people presented and what symptoms were asked and how did the patient react to those symptoms. And this is not only clinical symptoms. We actually ask a lot about socio-contextual cultural information, and we collected all of this information. These are patients in our sample. 45 were males. As you can see, fairly young population. Education really ranged across the board. 46% were employed, but 64 made an income of less than 15%. 50% were in Medicaid, and 58% were U.S. born. These are the providers. And one of the interesting findings is, as you can see there, we had around 67% of providers were female, mainly 35 to 49 was the most common age. But as you can see, a lot of providers were white providers that we're seeing a diverse range of patients. And they ranged pretty well in terms of psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, with a range of experience, with 0 to 5 years of experience to 16 or more. What we found in terms of the agreement, remember the agreement that I told you between the first clinician that saw the person and the second clinician that saw the videotape, is actually that there was actually very low agreement except for substance disorders. So actually, if you look at the agreement between the provider that saw the videotape and the provider that saw the patient, the kappas were 0.41, and if you think that's a fair kappa, a moderate kappa would be around 0.60. For any depressive disorder, 0.35 for any anxiety disorder. And this is not even specific to the disorder. This is just give me in what range this is. Is it a depressive disorder, an anxiety disorder, and a substance disorder? And even then, the kappas are very low. It's only for substance disorders that the kappas are good. This sort of suggests that two clinicians seeing that same patient would reach a different disorder of the person. Let me go very quickly in the statistical analysis. I'm not going to go because I don't have a lot of time and I want to spend time talking about the results. But what we wanted to do is really figure out what's the information that is used in terms of diagnostic decision making in that initial interview. What do providers use? So we use factor analysis to determine the cluster of symptoms that are used for decision making, and then we use structural equation modeling, trying to relate the diagnosis to the latent factors and see what types of information are associated to the decisions that providers make. We actually ran analysis similar to regression models with latent factors as covariates, controlling for sex, race, ethnicity, clinician type, and interview length, and included both the main effects of latent factors as well as the interactions between race, ethnicity, and the latent factors. And I'm not going to go there, but basically let me show you some of the results because I think it's quite interesting. First, I have to unfortunately go through this very quickly. I wish I had more time. But we found that in the qualitative, if you remember the qualitative post-diagnostic interviews, providers talked about four things, patients talk about four things that they wanted of their providers. They wanted listening, they wanted understanding, they wanted providers that spend time with them, and they wanted providers that could manage the differences between them and the patient. However, when you actually look at how people describe what they meant by listening, what they meant by understanding, and what they meant by spending time, they meant different things, depending if the patient was black, Latino, or non-Latino white. So the construct behind seemed to be the same, but when you actually ask people to give you examples, the examples of what they wanted were very different. So that's something I can explain in more detail. I'm going to go to the other things. The other things that interviewing the providers really gave us is how providers really have a very complex competing demands that they have to do in a 40 to 25 minute period. They're being asked to actually, you know, prioritize from engaging the patient to collecting all of this diagnostic information in a very short time and coming up with a treatment plan. If you imagine, this is fairly demanding for a clinician that's out there. So one of the things that happened, and this was so important, is that providers that use a symptom checklist and basically started their interviews just asking the patient about symptoms actually lost their patients. These were patients that after, in the post-diagnostic interview, said, I would not come to this provider. The person actually really doesn't understand me. They're really just like mechanical. So this really gave us a key of why providers are resisting so dramatically to use symptom checklists, you know, given that patients react quite negatively. This is a patient that said he was not coming back. He definitely didn't want that provider ever again. So it's really an interesting finding. The other thing we found when we actually did, if you remember those symptom checklists that I told you about, is that really, if you look at what was the information that providers collected on symptoms, it was actually very general information. It was general information about depression, anxiety, or substance use. They really didn't emphasize assessing specific symptoms of a disorder, and let me show you some of this data. This is, if you look at our sample, this is 121 that the videotapes were good enough to hear all the information. If you look about it, and we have a small black sample because this was a diversity supplement that Tara Earls, who's in our team, is actually, we were fortunate enough for her to collect this data, so we don't have a big sample. We hope that she extends this work and does it with the black sample. But what we found there, what you can see there, is people do ask screener questions, sort of very general information, such like you could say, have you been depressed? And the person says yes. That would be a screener question. Or have you been very worried? And the person says, yes, I've been pretty worried. But when you look at anxiety, agoraphobia, panic attacks, social phobia, very, very few cases get asked specific questions about specific symptoms. Let me even show you this, which is easier. And I don't exactly know why we can't see it all together, but I'll tell you what's behind the PTSD. Basically, if you look at the criteria for giving a person a disorder, out of the total 98 people that endorse at least one screener item, only around 34% in the ones of major depressive episode got at least assessed for five or more of the criteria of having a major depressive episode. If you look for, and this is fairly across the board for all the ethnic racial groups, same thing for alcohol abuse or dependence. Of the people that actually mention the screener item of having alcohol or dependence, if you think about it, only around 15 to 28% in the best of cases get assessed at least four out of the 11 criteria to get that disorder. So actually, you get very few people reporting disorders. We found, contrary to what we believe, and I was telling Cheryl Boyce this, we actually thought people will not ask about sociocultural, sociocontextual things, that people spend the majority of the time talking about things that had to do with who were you as a person. What was your employment? What was your conditions? Where were you living? So people spend the majority of the time in that intake session really trying to find out the living conditions of the patient and who they were as a person. And that actually seems to be very related to engagement. It's a very powerful way of engaging the patient. So the next thing we wanted to see is, well, given that they do this, do they collect different information depending on the race and ethnicity of the person? And what we found, if you remember those factor analysis that we told you, people actually have, we found they use seven factors to decide on the diagnosis of a person. And those seven factors are depression factor, an anxiety symptom factor, a trauma factor, a risky behavior, substance history factor, a mental health history and disability factor, an alcohol use factor, and a drug use factor. That's how the data gets compressed. What we found, and this I'm just going to present for Latinos and whites because the sample for blacks was so small, is that the discussion rates, if you were a Latino, you were more likely to be discussed on depression items and trauma items than if you had white and, you know, had reported similar screener items. So people tended to actually focus more on discussing depression and trauma with Latinos, and non-diagnostic information and substance use and stressors were less likely to be discussed with Latinos and more likely to be discussed with whites. So actually what we see is a differential pattern of what people, what the clinician, based on seeing you walk through the door, focuses more on asking you on that intake information. We saw the same thing for anxiety and substance use, where diagnosing anxiety disorders and trauma used to be more likely to be discussed with Latinos than with whites. I'm just going to tell you that there's so much missing information that people are doing a huge attribution of what people have based on race and ethnicity. But, you know, besides that, what we wanted to do, and I'm just going to very quickly go through this, is find out, well, maybe the population that people see in specialty care are very unique, and they're still doing a good job because only with a few questions they could do a pretty good assessment of what people have. So what we did is we went back to the NESAR example that has all of this information for Latinos, blacks, and whites, and actually said, well, if we match the information that we have in the PPS study to the NESARC information and select people like them and see, given the information that they're reporting, how good a job could these clinicians be making? How good a job? And that's what we did. And what we find is if you use that the NESARC information and collect all the possible information on, for example, depression, you actually have a rate of discordance of around 19%. And you have an overdiagnosis of around 7% of depression, and you would detect around 12% of people you would be under-detecting in the best possible circumstance. So this is what our clinicians were doing. Actually, what we found is with the information that they were collecting, they were actually, if they behaved like the people in the NESARC, they were actually would have a discordance in terms of what people have, of the disorder people have in terms of major depression, of around 40%. But the important issue here is the overdiagnosis of depression would be around 28%. And actually, this is the best case scenario. We actually played different assumptions. And even in the other assumptions, the overdetection would be much higher. Overdiagnosis of depression for Latinos would be much higher than you would imagine. However, if they use these five symptoms, if they actually collected only these five symptoms that you see here, we could actually improve their detection rate quite dramatically. Only five symptoms. So this is a next step that we want to do. Overall, our findings show that clinicians are very limited in the information they can are able to let their patients talk about because they are really trying to engage the patient and therefore are going to be very limited in the information they can collect. So what they tend to do is collect very general information, make assumptions about what's the diagnosis the person has, and then move on to really spending the time with the patient. But what this is really worrying us is that it's leading to clinicians deciding on what information to collect based on race, ethnicity of the patient. And second, that information is so limited that they're over-diagnosing. We think they're over-diagnosing certain conditions. And if you think about it, people say, well, is this important? Well, if you think about who gets, for example, antidepressants, it's quite dramatically a lot of people that don't fulfill criteria for depression and actually don't fulfill criteria for having even subthreshold or lifetime depression. So are we over-treating people because we are going with this approach? Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie. And I would like to introduce our next speaker, who is Dr. Irene Blair from the University of Colorado, where she is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology. Dr. Blair studies stereotyping and prejudice with a focus on the early or unconscious cognitive processes that contribute to these biases. She is currently conducting a collaborative study of the association between healthcare providers' racial ethnic biases and hypertension control that is funded by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. So, Dr. Blair?
That's me.
Oh, okay. Very busy there.
I was late in getting my presentation in, so I brought some handouts. I hope I brought enough for at least everyone to share with their neighbor so that you can follow along with me today. So my goals today, oops, microphone. I'm also used to talking loudly. My goals today are to provide a bit of a framework for talking about intergroup bias and racial ethnic disparities in healthcare, and then to summarize, at least just briefly, where I think we are at in terms of the research and where I think we still need to go. So let me start with a pretty simple question of what is bias? And in showing these images, you get a pretty clear idea here of the kinds of bias that I think first come to people's minds when they think of bias. These are nothing hidden here. We can figure out pretty clearly what these individuals' thoughts and feelings are toward various social groups, and we refer to this kind of bias as explicit intergroup bias, these feelings and beliefs about groups that are consciously held and acted upon. And this kind of bias we measure simply by asking someone. So for example, if I ask this group, how many of you do not like the Ku Klux Klan? Few people are willing to say there. I thought I'd get more hands up. Here's mine. My explicit bias that we can just ask people. This is what we do in national surveys. We ask people how warmly or coolly they feel toward different groups and so on. And as Dr. Payne will talk about after me, we tend to see quite a decline in this sort of bias we have historically anyway over time. Here's a completely different picture of the possibility of bias. Let me ask you another question. How many of you can clearly see that the squares labeled A and B are exactly the same color? Exactly the same color. Now, if I told you they are exactly the same color and you seeing them as different colors is bias, you can just change, right? Okay. This is where the handout can come in handy. You can fold your handout. Hopefully these printed correctly. And I will do this electronically, though people tend not to believe it, so it's useful to have the handout, that you can see the squares A and B really are the same color, and that what causes us to see them as different colors is really our sophisticated visual system compensating based on expectations that we have developed over a lifetime of viewing things like this. Let me show you another example. Here, these two tabletops are, if you mark out the length and width of each tabletop, are exactly the same dimensions. And typically we'd say in two-dimensional space, things that have the same dimensions are the same shape. And yet most people see the left table as being longer and thinner than the table on the right. Again, for me to tell you that that's what's accurate, and if you're seeing them as different, that's a bias, you can't really just say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to change my perception. I'm going to now see the world exactly as I ought to. And these examples are examples of, you know, we call in cognitive psychology, we call these perceptual illusions. There are dozens of them out there that are fun to play with. But if you think about it, if our complex, sophisticated visual systems, which typically work pretty well, can be fooled like this, how much room for error is there in our social perceptions and our subjective judgments? So in a different picture of bias, this is, you know, we're not medical folks, and so we don't actually think the brain looks this way. But it's a good schematic of another way to think of bias in terms of the associations that people may have accumulated over a lifetime. based on either what they have heard or seen in the media, from friends, learned early on. This is just a hypothetical example of the, some of the things that may be associated in one's mind with a group, in this case labeled blacks, that one may or may not agree with, yet you still have that association there. And this is a different form of bias that we refer to as implicit intergroup bias. So group associations that may not be consciously accepted, yet can still exert influence on thought and action. So obviously, in this kind of bias, we can't simply ask someone, what do you think or feel about different social groups? Because this form of bias may not be acknowledged, not accepted by the individual consciously. And so we have other means of assessing this. I'm going to give you an example just because it's the easiest one to show. And Dr. Payne will talk about others of the implicit association test. You can visit their website and do lots of fun things there. But what we do in these kinds of tests are, instead of asking people what they think, we ask them instead to do different tasks, to place pictures or words into groups that are considered congruent or incongruent with pre-existing associations, stereotypes or prejudice, read into there. And that instead of using people's verbal statements as an indicator, we look at how fast they can complete these different tasks, so that the strength of association is estimated from the speed of operation instead of the content of one's speech, such that faster responses on congruent than incongruent tasks, you get stronger associations, and you're all sitting there looking at me like, yeah. So the easiest way to get some better sense, I think, of what I'm trying to get at is to actually do it yourselves. And we're going to do this as a group demonstration. So this will wake you up. Free up your hands. Put your hands out. You can put them under the table if you don't want people around you to see what you're doing. Or you can put them right on top. Either way, that's fine. And what I'm going to ask you to do is to place a list of items into different groupings. And in this case, your first task is going to be to place these names into the two groups as traditionally or stereotypically black names or white names. If it's a black name, you're going to tap on the left. If it's a white name, you're going to tap on the right. So if I were going through this, I would go Adam, Jamal, Harry, Malik, Lamar, Jonathan, Terrell, Peter, Matthew, and so on, right? So just go through this at your own pace. Go ahead. I usually tell people, don't worry yet. This is just practice. This doesn't indicate anything yet. Okay. Now we're going to do the same thing with a list of negative and positive words. Again, just go through at your own pace, placing these into positive versus negative poles. Y'all are worse than the undergraduates. I'm barely hearing anything. You're not participating. Okay. You'll get extra credit. How about that? All right, here we go. Now, this is where it gets a little more complex, but this is the meat of the measure here. Where we put these together, we put the list together, and now you've got to do both tasks at the same time. So I'm going to put the lists up and then have you all start at the same time. So don't start yet, but just so you can see. And I've tried to code these by color, so that might make it a little easier. If you see a name, place that name into black or white groups. If you see a positive or negative word indicated in black ink, place that into negative or positive groups. So if I were going through this, Tyrone I would hit left, Filth I'd hit left, Frank I'd hit right, Death I'd hit left, Rashawn I'd hit left, and so on. Okay? Okay, so go ahead and do this at your own pace, but as quickly as you can. Thank you. Okay, good. You're getting the hang of it? Now I'm going to switch something on you. Now I'm going to put positive words on the left and negative words on the right. So please go ahead and practice this change in task. Do it twice if you feel like you need to get the hang of it. And now we're going to, again, combine the categories. This time, the names are the same. Black is on the left, white is on the right. But now if you see a positive word, that's now a left tap, and a negative word is now a right tap. So go ahead and do that as quickly as you can. When I do this with my students, I usually have them raise their hand when they're done, and then I measure the amount of time it takes about half the class to get through the task. And what I typically find in my undergraduate sections of 100 plus students, primarily white students, is that this second arrangement of the categories, going through the task this way, is much more difficult for them to get through and takes them longer to get through this task than the first way. Now, of course, you're saying, yeah, but you switched it up on me, so the second way is harder. So, of course, when we're doing this in research, we're going to counterbalance the ordering of that. It turns out if you have people do this in the reverse order, then they complain because they say, yeah, but I got faster as I went along because I got more practiced at the task. So, you know, there's always a reason either way you do it to talk about the results. But what we can do with this, when we measure this in a more sophisticated way than I'm doing here, obviously, we do these tasks with computers. We're measuring key presses in terms of milliseconds. And we can calculate effects in terms of differences in speed of being able to perform these different arrangements of the items. And what I'm showing you here along the y-axis is the strength of association in terms of Cohen's D, so defined as a null, a small, medium, or large effect. Going up higher is more pro-white bias. Going lower, below zero, is a more pro-minority bias. We collected these data. These were data we collected actually in healthcare clinics with community members. So we just went into the waiting rooms. We wanted to get a diverse and a wide-ranging sample of community members. So we went to a number of clinics in the Denver Health, which is a safety net system in Denver, Colorado. And we had individuals complete this kind of thing twice, once to get an indication of responses to a black versus white, similar to what I did here, except we used pictures and had it better in other ways, and then a Latino-white IAT as well. First, let me show you the results for our African-American participants. This result, perhaps surprisingly, is not pro-minority. It's not pro-black, pro-African-American. It's actually statistically, it's a small effect because of the number of participants. It's non-significant from zero. Our Latino participants you are seeing here are showing a much more substantial pro-white as compared to African-American bias on this task. And our white participants, you can see, are showing extremely pro-white implicit preference here. In terms of the Latino-white IAT, I'll just put the first two bars there. You can see almost a reversal, that the Latinos in our sample are essentially showing no difference. They're not going pro-Latino. They're just not showing a difference. Our African-Americans in the sample now are showing pro-white, and our white participants continue to show very strong pro-white over Latino bias here. We have some initial data from healthcare providers that I'm not going to put up here because we measured it in a little bit different ways, but there are certainly preliminary results from my work and also from others' work that shows providers are humans too and probably have some similar biases going on. So how might ethnic and racial bias affect healthcare? I think there's no argument, especially given the presentations we've seen today, that the patient-provider interaction is extremely critical for good healthcare. There needs to be clear communication, accurate communication, a belief that everyone is involved in good faith in this interaction. Providers have certain tasks that they need to accomplish, including perhaps the symptom checklist, also trying to understand the background, family support, the cooperativeness of their patient, I think is a judgment that comes up. On the other side, the patient wants to know, does my provider hear me, understand me? Is this person trustworthy and dependable? And this can be a difficult enough interaction, and the question we have to ask is what happens when bias enters into it, and which parts of this get messed up? We don't know. And then we don't know if what gets messed up in that interaction affects the kind of treatment that is offered, the treatment that's accepted, ongoing adherence, and follow-up. These are all questions that really are still out there. So let me very quickly go through where I think we are now in the literature. I think we know in a really good substantial way that there are ethnic and racial disparities in healthcare that cannot be explained by biological, socioeconomic, or access factors. There are data that suggests that healthcare providers view their black and white patients differently, and some very preliminary data that suggests providers have similar ethnic racial biases as other humans out there. And we have one study only that has shown that providers' implicit racial biases predict their treatment decisions in a hypothetical scenario. There is also another study that shows that it doesn't predict. So we don't have hard evidence there either at the moment. So what do we still need? As a social psychologist, I think we really need to get in there and get direct investigations of the link between ethnic racial bias and healthcare. We need to know about this on the side of the providers, on the side of the patients, and also the wider setting in which healthcare interactions take place. You know, how much of us have had an experience to our provider get ruined by the administrative staff or someone else in the office that has treated us rudely or unfairly. We need a better understanding of when, where, and how ethnic racial bias might affect healthcare. Is it in patients' perceptions of providers, providers' perceptions of patients, the clinical interaction, those nonverbal behaviors, in treatment decisions and adherence? And finally, we need that intervention piece, the interventions that address the unique challenges of implicit bias, because I hope, as I demonstrated with some of those cognitive illusions, these kinds of associations aren't ones that you can simply say, oh, now that I know, I'm going to stop doing it. These kinds of associations fundamentally affect how we view the world, how we interpret that information, and we think we're going about things in a fair and unbiased manner, and in fact, we just don't even know where we are going wrong. Finally, I just want to leave you with acknowledgments of generous support by the NHLBI and NCI and some individuals in those organizations, and then my collaborators who have really shaped my thinking about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Blair. Our next speaker and the last in this particular session is Dr. Keith Payne. Dr. Payne is a psychologist who teaches at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and his research focuses on social cognition, the processes underlying thoughts and feelings about people and socially important issues. He is especially interested in unintended and the unconscious, and he's interested in addressing questions such as why people sometimes act in prejudicial ways even when they intend to be fair, How do people set aside unwanted biases and act the way they want to, and what happens when these processes break down? And in his research, he uses a variety of methods ranging from behavioral experiments to large-scale surveys and to mathematical modeling. So, Dr. Payne?
Thank you, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me. It's great to be here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Well, following from the theme that Dr. Blair started, what I want to talk to you about today is how we measure and how we understand some of the roots of racial discrimination in the form of implicit race bias. And as has already been mentioned this morning, a lot of times when we think about prejudice or racism, what we think of is this image of an overt bigot. But we know that the image of prejudice in America has been changing for some time, and so we can see in questions like this one, for example, what's the proportion of Americans who disapprove of marriage between whites and blacks? I mentioned this one because it's been asked in a consistent way by polling agencies since at least 1958, and we see this very steep change, so that even though today not 100% of Americans say that they approve, in 1958 it was almost zero. And so judging from, you see the same sort of trend in just about any kind of questions like these that you would want to look at. And so if you were to make a judgment based on just data like these, you'd get the sorts of conclusions that we were talking about earlier this morning, in which people say, well, racial discrimination must just be a thing of the past, right? But we know the story's not that simple, and we have good evidence that racial discrimination is still very much with us. And some of the best evidence for that comes from audit studies, or sometimes called paired testing studies, which sends testers out into the field, pairs of testers that are matched on everything except they're of different races. So they're matched in terms of resumes if they're applying to jobs, or they're matched in terms of housing history using bogus credentials if they're trying to rent apartments, credit history if they're trying to buy cars. And we've had these kinds of studies going on for about three decades now. And reviews of the literature have been consistent in concluding that discrimination has been fairly constant over that time period. So one review of the literature in 1998 said, the discriminatory barriers show no signs of diminishing over the past 20 years, a direct contradiction of the predicted disappearance of discrimination, that prediction that you would have made if you had focused on that polling sort of question. So what are we to make of this sort of conflict between the reported attitudes of Americans on one hand and the consistent discrimination on the other? And one way to look at it is what psychologist Gordon Allport diagnosed as the problem as early as 1954 by saying that even when defeated intellectually, prejudice lingers emotionally. And this sort of insight about the contradiction between people's intellectual principles and their emotional reactions has formed the heart of several theories of modern prejudice. And these theories all agree that modern or contemporary forms of bias are much more likely to be subtle than to be blatant, more likely to be emotional than to be intellectually endorsed. And these sorts of theories of modern or symbolic prejudice form the backdrop for what I really want to focus on today, which is sort of the state of art in thinking about prejudice from a cognitive perspective, which is dual process theories of prejudice. And dual process theories distinguish between consciously controlled aspects of cognition and automatic or implicit aspects of cognition. And when I say something's automatic, I mean thoughts and feelings that come to mind spontaneously, they happen fast, and they can influence behavior without awareness and sometimes despite conscious intent to the contrary. And although conscious cognition and implicit cognition can both influence behaviors, the relative contribution of the two seems to depend critically on the degree of motivation and resources that people bring to bear in thinking carefully about what they're doing. So psychologist Dan Gilbert summarizes it nicely by saying that one of psychology's fundamental insights is that judgments are generally the products of non-conscious systems that operate quickly on the basis of scant evidence and in a routine manner, and then pass their hurried approximations to consciousness, which slowly and deliberately adjusts them. All right. So the reason that these dual process theories are so important for understanding prejudice is that when you ask somebody to report their racial attitudes, what they tend to report are those conscious adjustments. Right? So they'll fill out questionnaires by presenting the kind of person that they think they are, the kind of person that they would like to be, or the kind of person that they would like to present to the interviewer. And that may or may not agree with the automatic or spontaneous gut reactions that they're having. So, pass that up. I want to talk about a few patterns that we see over and over again in the hundreds of studies that have now been done comparing implicit and explicit measures of prejudice. First is that implicit and explicit bias tend to predict behaviors independently. So what I'm showing you here is simply a schematic summarizing a simple study that we ran a few years ago, in which we measured people's implicit racial attitudes, and in a way I'll tell you about how that was done in a few minutes, and their explicit racial attitudes using standard self-report questionnaires. And then we asked people to form an impression of a person based on a vignette, and that was the vignette was held constant in all conditions, but the person was described in half the cases as an African-American person and in half the cases as a white person. And what we found is that implicit and explicit measures of attitudes jointly and independently predicted the kinds of impressions that subjects formed of that black character. That is, each controlling for the other in a regression sort of analysis. The reason this sort of independent prediction is important is because what it shows you is that if you had relied only on self-report measures, you'd have only gotten half the story. The second kind of pattern that we see over and over again is that implicit and explicit bias predict behaviors under different kinds of conditions. So for example, in studies of interracial interaction, several studies have replicated this finding that explicit reports of racial attitudes predict the verbal content of what whites say in these interactions. But implicit tests don't predict the verbal content of what they say, but instead they predict how they say it and the sorts of nonverbal body language that people convey. So these are things like eye contact, body posture, seating distance, those sorts of things. These subtle nonverbal cues that can establish or disrupt rapport. And finally, one other pattern of implicit and explicit bias is that they tend to predict the same behaviors, but under different kinds of circumstances. In particular, when cognitive resources are high, that is, when people are well-rested and paying attention and able to concentrate on what they're doing, explicit attitudes and beliefs are most important. But under conditions in which cognitive resources are low, that is, conditions of fatigue or stress or hurry, this is when implicit biases come to the fore and often play a larger role than explicit attitudes and beliefs. And so if we think about the kinds of conditions under which healthcare might often be delivered, conditions of long hours, fatigue, stress, rushed calendars, and so forth, these are exactly the kinds of conditions in which we might expect implicit bias to play the largest role. Okay, so I've given you a general overview so far of the kinds of patterns and the kinds of insights that can be generated by looking at implicit as opposed to explicit tests. Now I want to look in a little bit more detail about exactly what I mean by implicit tests and how these sort of measures work. And the most widely used implicit test is the implicit association test, which Dr. Blair gave you a very nice demonstration of just a few minutes ago. So I'm not going to spend much time detailing this test since you've seen for yourself how it works. I'll just remind you that this is a reaction time based test in which we, by looking at each individual subject's pattern of fast responses and slow responses, we can infer whether the categories black and white are more compatible with the categories good or bad for that individual. So what happens if you take this sort of approach? Well, one thing that happens is that you find vastly greater estimates of prejudice than if you look simply at self-report measures. So about 75% of people who have taken the IAT tend to show pro-white preference. That's much lower if you look at explicit or self-report measures. The second thing you see is that the IAT and self-reported prejudice tend to be positively correlated, but not overwhelmingly. Right? It's a moderate to small correlation. In meta-analyses, it averages of about 0.2. And what that tells us is that although they're going in the same direction, there's a lot of unique variance not accounted for in one by the other. And you can see that uniqueness even more clearly when you look at how implicit or the IAT and self-reports of prejudice predict discriminatory behavior. And these, again, are estimates from a meta-analysis. And what we find is that they predict behavior independently of each other, with implicit attitudes sometimes predicting even more strongly than self-report. So again, if you only were relying on self-report in these studies, you'd be missing more than half of the story. And so you can see the importance of not just relying on self-report in the study I want to tell you about next, which this is the same study Dr. Blair alluded to. This is the first study of its kind that I know of to actually examine the contribution of implicit and explicit bias to discrimination in the context of healthcare. And in this study, they had a sample of 220 physicians who did an internet-based study in which they had to make treatment recommendations based on scenarios in which a vignette that described a patient's symptoms. So in this study, a patient presented with chest pain and other symptoms, and it was randomly manipulated whether the patient was described as white or black. And the question was, what was the likelihood that the physicians would prescribe treatment with thrombolysis, which was it's a clot-busting treatment deemed to be appropriate for the symptoms that they included in that vignette. So after making their treatment recommendations, the physicians completed an IAT as well as self-report measures of their attitudes towards whites and blacks. And there are a couple of key findings I want to point out here. The first is that, just like the general population, these physicians also showed higher levels of implicit bias on the IAT than on self-reported bias. So these are just standardized effect sizes for the two different kinds of measures. Higher numbers indicate greater race bias. But even more important, what they found was that the implicit test, but not the explicit test, correlated with the kinds of treatment recommendations that the physicians made. But the pattern is intriguing here. So one way to look at this pattern is to say that higher race bias on the IAT correlated negatively with giving the appropriate treatment recommendation to the black patient, but positively with giving the appropriate treatment recommendation to the white patient. But the other way to look at these data is to say that for those who are high in IAT bias, that is high in prejudice, they actually were treating the black and white patients the same. And it was for those who were low in IAT bias who actually treated the patients differentially, in this case, being more likely to prescribe the appropriate treatment for the black patient than the white patient. Right? And so clearly the IAT is picking up on some interesting, meaningful patterns in the data, but this is not the sort of pattern you would expect to mediate discriminatory treatment in which the black patient receives poorer care. And so I think it's interesting, since this is the first study I know of, it raises additional questions that I think have to be looked at in further research, but it also lets us know that something seems to be going on with implicit biases that are not being detected with explicit biases. Right? And so we can talk about that pattern in more detail at the question and answer period if you want. But more generally, I want to focus on some of the strengths and weaknesses of the IAT method for assessing implicit bias that researchers ought to know about if you're considering using these sorts of methods. First is that the IAT has quite good psychometrics in terms of high internal consistency. It shows meaningful patterns of correlations with other attitude and behavior type measures. And it also has very high sensitivity, by which I mean if a person has a bias, the IT is very likely to pick it up. On the other hand, the IET has been criticized on a number of grounds that I would sort of summarize as potentially low specificity. So for example, some research has shown that simply knowing that somebody else holds a stereotype is enough to produce an IET bias in regardless of whether the person taking the test themselves believes the stereotype. And a second sort of criticism that's been brought up with the IET is that it's difficult to disentangle different specific kinds of racial sentiments that might underlie an IET score. So for example, one study showed that having dislike toward a group or feelings of pity toward that group because they're disadvantaged produced equivalent IET sort of scores. So clearly these are different kinds of racial sentiments that would lead to different kinds of behaviors. And finally, as you saw, there are several different phases to this test that makes it somewhat complex to administer. And it takes about 15 minutes to do a computer-based version. So that can limit its utility in certain research contexts like survey research. And so it was with the idea of preserving some of these very important strengths and overcoming some of these obstacles that my colleagues and I have developed a different measure that we think is very much complementary to the IET. We call it the affect misattribution procedure, or AMP for short. And the way this works is that it's also a computerized test. Subjects see a prime picture flash very briefly on the screen, a white or a black face, for example, in this case. And then it's followed by an ambiguous object. We often use Chinese pictographs, so that assuming you can't, if you can't read that, it's an ambiguous object for you. And we ask participants to judge whether the pictograph is pleasant or unpleasant. Okay. And what we find in study after study is that even though subjects are warned not to let the race influence their judgment, they can't do that. Right? So we can tell from the relative evaluations of the pictographs on black versus white prime trials an indirect measure of how they're what affective reactions they're having to those faces. What's nice about this is because it doesn't rely on reaction time, we can get by with fewer trials and reach high reliability fairly quickly, so that makes it fast and easy to administer. And that makes it feasible for more large-scale survey sorts of contexts. So just one quick example I'll show you. We did this in a pilot study for the National Election Study and found that the AMP bias here is simply the difference score in evaluations of the Chinese pictographs on trials with black faces versus white faces. So much like with the IET, we find higher rates of implicit bias than explicit bias among whites and Hispanics. We also tend to find a reversal of that, a pro-black bias among African-American respondents. And whereas the self-reported preference self-reported bias is lower for whites and Hispanics than it is for the implicit bias, it actually exceeds the bias on the self-report scale, which is kind of interesting. I'm not going to pause on that right now because I'm about out of time. But I also want to point out that we find, again, independent predictive validity, so that implicit attitudes and explicit attitudes jointly predict support for a black president in this sample. Let's see. I also want to mention that the measure has good specificity in terms of disentangling different specific emotions underlying bias. So in this study, we use primes to elicit very different emotions, disgust, fear, sexual desire, and happiness, for example, and ask subjects to guess the meaning of the Chinese word. And all I want you to take away from this figure is that subjects were most likely to guess each specific emotion when it was paired by a specific emotional elicitor. So people were more likely to guess that the word meant disgust whenever it was primed by something that was disgusting than those other emotional reactions. And what that means from the perspective of discrimination is that we can do the same sort of thing. I'm just going to run through this very quickly because I'm out of time. But we measured fear and anger responses to Middle Eastern men, and we find that implicit fear responses predict support for defensive actions against Iran, such as giving money to our allies to protect their borders in the Middle East, whereas explicit anger responses predict support for direct military intervention in Iran. All right, so very different kinds of emotions underpinning very different kinds of potentially discriminatory behavior. Okay, so let me just wrap up by pointing out that I think there are some very clear questions that we're now in a position to ask, armed with these sorts of implicit measures. One is, do implicit or explicit attitudes mediate discriminatory treatment by providers? Because we would have different kinds of interventions targeted at implicit as opposed to explicit biases. And I'll go ahead and stop there. You can see those for yourself, and I'm happy to answer questions about them during the question and answer period. Thank you.
If Dr. Alegria and Dr. Blair would join Dr. Payne at the table. And we're going to borrow 10 minutes from the lunchtime so that you all will have enough time to ask your questions from these three really stimulating presentations. So if you will come to a microphone and give us your name.
Thomas DeVries from Johns Hopkins. My question is for Dr. Payne about the technique that you just described. Can you talk a little bit more about how that is deployed in a national survey?
Right. So we've been working with a company that actually does internet-based large-scale surveys. And what they do is they recruit people through standard probability sampling using telephones, and then they ask them to take part in this study, and if they don't have internet access, they actually provide it for them. And so the research firm does the probability sampling and setting up of the technology. And we have internet-based applications through Flash, for example, that we can use to actually collect the data online. And I'm happy to share those software pieces with researchers who are interested.
So you need respondents that have internet access?
Well, what the research firm we've worked with does is actually provides internet access for any respondents who are interested in participating but don't have it. So it's part of the incentives for taking part in the research study is that they get a computer and internet set up for a specified amount of time. There are two companies out there that I know of who are doing this now.
My question is for Dr. Payne and Dr. Blair. I'm just fascinated by your work on implicit prejudice. And I know you were both rushed. Could you talk a little bit more so I can get a good feel of how it is being used in terms of looking at its health, its relationship to health, and what drives it, both from it's easier for me to understand what you might expect to find in terms of looking at the provider's implicit biases. But then when you give it to a respondent, a client, what do you expect to find? What has been found in the literature? It's a question. I really don't know what's happening in this area. And if you could talk about both, and if you think it might have implications for health in addition to the provider-patient interaction.
So I guess I think the bottom line answer is we don't really know. We don't have really much research on this at all. It's just starting to be used in a healthcare context. There is more research actually looking at implicit attitudes and their predictive ability in terms of health behaviors. So what your implicit attitudes are about smoking or dieting or condom use or these kinds of things predicting people's behavior. So there actually is more research there, and it shows to have some independent predictive validity there over and above people's self-report desire to smoke or drink alcohol or whatever. I would say in the patient-provider interaction that there could very well be some similar effects on both sides. In my own work, I focus on the provider. I'm not a medical expert, but my understanding and certainly my feeling when I'm in that clinic is that the provider has the power in that situation. And so it's that person who is driving a lot of the interaction. But you could still certainly get the same kinds of discomfort, prejudgment, nonverbal signals from a patient to the provider that, you know, an interaction is both ways. And so if there's unease and discomfort on both sides, that could certainly interfere.
I would just add to that that some of the things that came up in this morning's talks, like the kinds of attributions people make for potentially discriminatory behavior, I would think those sort of subjective construals would be very tightly linked to the spontaneous attitude. So that, for example, if patients who have different attitudes toward healthcare providers, for instance, might make very different kinds of attributions when faced with the exact same stimulus that Dr. Leveist, I think, was talking about earlier.
I'm Martha Hare from NCI's Center to Reduce Cancer Health Disparities. And I also have a question about the application of this work. And from your last answer, I think I know the answer. But I'd still like your insights and opinions. I've had a lot of concern about the construct of the term cultural competency. I have a real concern that some of the training that I've seen, especially, I think it's gotten more sophisticated over the years, but I still have a concern that it reinforces a lot of patterns that people hold in their minds about other groups. Is there any work being done on applying this research to the training of healthcare workers, and in particular, a sort of at the community health worker, advocate, case manager, patient navigator level? Or do you have any thoughts about how this work could be applied to that kind of research?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think we're really at the very beginning stages of anybody even beginning to think about these sorts of questions. So I'm not actually aware of any research that's been done addressing those issues. The closest thing that comes to mind is some basic research on the different ways that people deal with diversity in terms of thinking of it as multiculturalism as opposed to colorblind approaches to diversity. And those have been linked to the different kinds of attitudes that people bring to the situation. So I can definitely see a potential link there, but I don't think anybody's, to my knowledge, been going in that direction so far.
Yeah, I think we place providers in a pretty difficult position because on the one hand we say do not pay attention to people's race and ethnicity, that's irrelevant information, and then on the other hand sometimes in these cultural competency classes we say you have to pay a lot of attention to these things to figure out what you should and should not do. And so I think we end up, you know, kind of going from one extreme to the other. And I think one potential use that implicit bias research and education can have is being able to have open discussion about the ways that race and ethnicity affect us, and not necessarily making a person a bad person. That these are cognitive mechanisms, these are mechanisms that people may or may not have a whole lot of control over, and that maybe we can be more open about these effects, at least more aware when we're not trying to block something that may make us feel bad about ourselves.
I was actually going to say that, I mean, I think this area should be tied to more support for providers, because I think the worry I have is that, I mean, some of the work people have done actually shows a backlash, that people actually become even more defensive because of their behavior. So I think work like people are doing now on actually having people really reflect journals and really reflect on what they're doing and really become more aware, but in a way that supports them, it's the way to go. Because I agree about the social competency. I'm very worried about the cultural competency and how that's being put out there as a panacea to really solve those problems. But I don't, if you look at the work that Georgetown University has done, the people there, the effect doesn't seem to be very strong.
A lot of times when we say automatic, people hear rigid and inflexible, and that's not really the case with these implicit attitudes. There's a lot of research, including Dr. Blair, showing that the kinds of automatic reactions or implicit attitudes that are activated in a given situation are actually very malleable and depend on the kinds of interpretations that people bring to the situation. So thinking about an interaction through the lens of multicultural competency might actually bring different attitudes to the fore.
Rachel Ballard-Barbash from NCI. My question is stimulated by the one study that looked at the influence of IPA on thrombolysis, which is actually a very new field of treatment, a very controversial field of treatment, and very much modulated by the multiple comorbidities that generally elderly patients bring to that clinical episode and the decisions to be made. So my question is, how much work has been done to characterize the clinical decision process, the level of its complexity, and whether one can really make an automatic decision, a very rapid-fire decision in that circumstance, and how that is then influenced by discrimination in healthcare? Because I've not heard about that side of the equation and how one's considering both what exists in that discrimination, interventions that might be relevant. So for any of the speakers.
I think, you know, I think this decision-making process is really important, partly because at least in the diagnostic aspect that we're seeing that people say, well, I made this decision to give them the diagnosis, but then when we ask them, well, how did you go through it, we see a lot of implicit actions being taken. And people talk about intuition a lot. People talk about, well, I just knew it. People talk about nonverbal. Even if the person says, I have anxiety, and the person says, but I knew it was depression because of the way the person was. So the nonverbal leading to a lot of the decision making, too. My concern is that, you know, in a diverse environment, people are not necessarily, their posture might be very different, their eye contact might be very different. And I think the lack of diversity on interpreting those signals can also be off. Like, I've been in environments where people have said, this person, medical student was not very engaged. He didn't look at the person in the eyes. He was not assertive. And I was thinking, well, you know, that person's Asian, and maybe they, you know, would not necessarily react in the same way given. And actually, the interesting thing is the patients were saying what a wonderful provider that was. So it was very contradictory to the model, I think, that's very using Western medical schools. So I also think this lack of being able to interpret different signals in from diverse cultures and being might lead to lack of good decision making just by intuition. I think trying to understand the intuition is something we need to do more, and how it's affecting either by implicit bias or by how people have to use cognitive shortcuts.
Yeah, my question is a little related to what you just said. In your videotapes, when the providers were being sympathetic and condescending or paternalistic, and, you know, I guess those are, that's what I'm understanding as implicit bias, how good were the patients at picking it up? You know, and so I wonder, you know, what kind of reactions patients.
I could tell you more about, I mean, it's very hard for patients to tell, this person was really being discriminatory to me or something. But it's amazing how much patients actually were recognizing aspects of the interaction that were negative. I mean, they do report it. For example, to give you an idea, we had this case, actually, where there's a paper that is a revise and resubmit on this, on a provider that was actually very, like, he, from the very beginning, he told us, you know, after in the post-diagnostic interview, this is a person that when came in, I knew I was not going to treat them. I don't like substance abuse patients, for example. And he just said that, you know, immediately. And then over the course of the interview, the patient changes and starts crying, and the provider drops his things, starts talking to the patient, and it's like a 360-degree shift between the patient and the provider. And in the post-diagnostic interview, they both talk about that event being like a complete change. The
patients saying, you know, I was not going to stay with that provider, I didn't, and then, you know, I saw that provider change and I really changed my conception. So it was really interesting seeing how there are certain events, even in a situation where there's a lot of stereotypes and both talk about it, that can actually be modified by some experience during the patient-provider interview. And that's the thing we're trying to understand. How can you shift it? What are the events that can shift that sense of either fear, because the person said, I didn't want to treat this person because they looked like a thug, and then they later on see the person and their vulnerability and decide, this is a person I really want to treat.
Okay. That's one of the best examples of individuation I've ever heard, which is really quite interesting. But I have a question about your low kappas. Did you run a kappa for whether the observing clinician gave a diagnosis at all?
So the way the kappas, so we ask when the person saw the patient, we asked them, okay, give them the diagnosis that you think, primary, secondary, or any other. And then to the clinician that was watching the videotape, we told them, blind to whatever the clinician saw, give them whatever diagnosis you think this person has. And we asked them, please give it at the level of the specific diagnosis and also at the level of, you know, an aggregate diagnosis. And the low kappas were for both anxiety and depression, and even worse if we wanted to talk about the specific disorders.
So the kappas were for when diagnosis was given, for example, by the clinician, but the observer didn't give any diagnosis at all?
No. The observer said, so it includes, so for example, I say this person has depression, and the clinician watching the video says, no, this person has anxiety.
And what would that be?
So that would be an discordant.
Yeah, but that will depend upon, that's a lot of things. Okay, so the kappas actually would be higher for whether they gave any diagnosis at all. So it has to be.
Well, our assumption was that it would be a little higher. The literature actually is quite, this literature, it's very, the same consistent finding has been finding other studies of two clinicians seeing the same patient. But we thought, you know, it's a very, it's specialty clinics, it'll be easier. But that was not the case.
Yeah. One last question about the so has there been developmental studies done with regard to the implicit issue? For example, do children are they lower on this or not? And to what extent do your findings represent real restrictions of range on the variation? The explicit measures always are going to have lack of variation. That was clear from even what you showed us. So to what extent, when you take that into consideration, do you get better relationships? You didn't mention that in your work.
Right. So as far as the second issue first, I don't think restriction of range is necessarily a problem on these implicit measures because, you know, at least in my experience working with them, the range is extraordinarily wide. So. Oh, the explicit. I see. Okay. So in college samples, that's often an issue. But you know, at least in the larger scale surveys, we got quite a lot of variability, even on the explicit measures. And so we often look at it through sort of a moderator sort of analysis. Under what conditions do implicit and explicit relate? And at least in some cells of that design, or some cells of the 2x2, you have quite a lot of prejudice being expressed. Yeah. And the other part of your question was about developmental studies. In the larger literature, there have been a few developmental studies. Irene actually might be able to speak to this better than I, but we know that implicit attitudes do seem to, race attitudes do seem to develop very early. So I think 6-year-olds, for example, in one study already show IET scores very similar to adults.
Now, I was going to say what tends to, at least, again, this is a limited literature, but the few studies that have been done, these are primarily coming out of work of Mazarin Banaji and her colleagues, is that what changes over time is that young children say very strongly that they don't like people of other races, and as people, these are cross-sectional, not longitudinal studies, but it's the older folks. So the older folks are expressing less explicit prejudice, but the implicit is staying about the same across the age groups. And then I wanted to say something about the, there are clearly measurement benefits and drawbacks to each class of measures. Implicit measures tend to have lower internal reliability, and so there are issues around that, and yours maybe is better. But that has historically been an issue with implicit measures and trying to get them to predict things to deal with some of these reliability issues. But the, you know, the restriction in range of explicit measures, you know, I expect we'll very much find that. I'm about to engage in a study with providers, and I think we will find that with providers. They'll be, they'll generally say they're not explicitly biased, and there's very low variance. And so I don't expect those measures to predict treatment and health outcomes. And that's sort of the nature of what explicit bias is.
Okay.
For this group.
I really hate to have to cut this off, but then you all will all be disappointed with no dinner. But thanks so much to our panel and then to all of the really interesting questions that you all followed up.
Good afternoon. I think we'll get started. As you may have noticed, this morning had a fairly quick pace, so I think we're going to try to get started even though everybody hasn't returned from lunch, and we'll just let them come in at their own leisure, but just so we can give the speakers their due amount of time and have enough minutes at the end for questions and answers. So we'll stay with the same format that we had this morning, whereby we'll have each speaker, and then we'll open it up for questions and comments at the end. This afternoon, we have, in this particular session on funded research, this is research that's actually been funded through the program announcement, The Effect of Racial and Ethnic Discrimination and Bias in Healthcare Deliveries. So our first speaker will be Dr. Gloria Bozzoli, and she is the Bon Secours Professor of Health Administration with the Department of Health Administration at Virginia Commonwealth University. She conducts economic research on U.S. hospital operations and functioning of hospital markets. Dr. Bozzoli has been a lead investigator on several research projects, including studies of financial pressures affecting the hospital safety net, the relationship between hospital financial condition and quality of care, and the effects of hospital mergers and closure on markets. Currently, she's the principal investigator, again, of one of the studies that has been funded under this PA. It's a multi-year grant from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, studying the influence of safety net hospital services and capacity on health disparities among racial and ethnic minorities. I'm also pleased to say that this study is one that I'm project officer of, so I'm very happy to bring forth Dr. Bozzoli.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and very appreciative of the grant that we received from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Our project is a three-year study. As Dr. Wells mentioned, we're looking at the effect of the safety net on disparities. In particular, what we want to study is looking at patient proximity. Where are they located relative to safety net hospitals, and how does that affect the care that they receive? Our working hypothesis is pretty simple. If an uninsured individual lives close to a safety net institution, they should receive greater benefit from those that are farther away. We also want to look at what happens when safety net hospitals close. Right? What happens when those institutions close down? Or alternatively, what happens when the safety net institution changes ownership? It goes from a public institution to a nonprofit or maybe to a for-profit. Right? what happens to the care in that community when that change occurs in hospital status. I want to acknowledge my colleagues from RTI, especially Lee Mobley, who's been quite involved in terms of some of the work that we've been doing to date. I'm going to be presenting preliminary work. We're about... I guess we could... Is this... This works.
Obviously, we have no idea what these knobs are doing. They changed the channel. That's...
Is this any better if I use this?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for bringing that up, and please do raise it if that continues to be a problem. Well, the first thing I want to talk about is, well, to give you a sense of what I want to do. First, I want to provide some context. Again, I've studied the safety net. I want to talk about generally the U.S. health safety net and talk about the role that safety net hospitals play. So just to give you some background. Then I'll give you an overview of our study. I've kind of done that a little bit, but I want to talk about what motivated our study to begin with, some of the things we see in the environment that concerned us. And then I'm going to talk about some preliminary evidence we have from the state of Florida. All right. In our analysis, we're looking at five different states. Florida is one of them. And we've begun our work in Florida given some of the things that we observed in that state that concerned us in relation to the safety net. Certainly, it's not representative, but it's a starting point. And I would really enjoy to hear your reactions to what we're seeing in the state, because I come at this not as someone who has done disparities research. I have studied the hospital safety net, so that's my expertise. Okay, great. All right. Thank you. All right, well, let me talk first about the structure of the safety net, and this is something that probably many of you understand, but let me just cover it for those who don't. There is a patchwork system of providers involved with treating the economically disadvantaged, or more generally, the uninsured. Certainly, hospitals, especially public hospitals, play a role, as do many non-for-profit hospitals that have a committed mission. Private physicians, of course, working at hospitals and the emergency department, also private physicians on their own, volunteering in free clinics, treating patients who have lost their insurance within their normal practices. So we have this patchwork of providers, and an important thing to think about is what's the relative contribution of each in relation to the safety net. And there was a study that was done by Jack Hadley and John Hallahan a few years ago to try to quantify the amount of care that different providers offer to the uninsured. That was really their intent. And here are the numbers that they came up with. It's a very interesting study. There's a lot of apples and oranges here in terms of how they try to create these numbers. But the obvious thing that I'm trying to highlight here is the important role that hospitals play. Nearly two-thirds of the care to the uninsured that Hadley and Hallahan quantified relate to public and private hospitals. All right? And what is it that hospitals do? I'm sure you're aware of quite many things that hospitals do. Uninsured patients present, especially at the ED. They might have urgent care needs that need to be addressed. Hospitals, either out of the goodness of their heart, benevolence, may provide charity care, free care, or they may do it because they have to. EMTALA requires hospitals to provide emergency treatment to care, but there are some hospitals that go above and beyond the normal call of duty. So we have this reactive role when patients show up in the hospital ED in terms of what hospitals are doing. But there's also what I would call a proactive role that we've seen hospitals try to develop, certain hospitals in particular, especially public institutions, within their marketplace. And these are the kinds of things that we see public hospitals doing, are trying to do,
in terms of offering outreach to uninsured patients, providing free or reduced fee primary care services in decentralized locations, collaborating with local agencies for referral, coordinating access or providing specialty services, and providing treatment and rehabilitation after hospitalization. Not every safety net hospital does this, but many of them attempt to do some of these things to try to reach out to populations and provide more than just minimum care. Right? But are safety net hospitals effective? If they're doing these things, are we seeing better care for the uninsured? And in particular, are we seeing improvement for minorities, racial or ethnic minorities, given the kinds of things that these institutions say that they're doing? On the one hand, we know that from a geographic perspective, these institutions are located in the right places. They are located in communities where a large number of poor ethnic and racial minorities exist. So they're in the right places to have an effect. But the research that's out there shows very little effect of safety net hospitals on access to care on the one hand and disparities on the other. All right. The morning sessions today began to help me understand part of the reason for this. Even though hospitals are doing such things as having outreach, advertising their services, if it's not affecting that interaction between the patient and the nurse, the patient and the physician, they're not going to be effective. But there are other reasons why prior research has not done a very good job of showing the effect of safety net institutions, and that is because the measures of safety net institutions, resources, availability, capacity, have been pretty crude. And this is where we're trying to improve the literature. The motivation for our study, we're looking at where uninsured individuals are located relative to the safety net institutions. We think that those that live closer have better access to these healthcare services, especially if these institutions are adopting a proactive role in trying to affect health in their communities. We're trying to see if this is a particularly important for minority individuals, for racial or ethnic minorities. We're looking at what happens if a safety net institution closes. These first group of bullets and sub-bullets, that relates to the quantitative work we're doing. We're also going to be doing some qualitative work related to that last bullet. Also, beyond trying to fill the gaps of prior research, an important thing that's motivating our project is what's been happening to hospitals over the last decade or so. And this slide kind of captures some of the main issues. There's a lot of pressures on hospitals generally, and a safety net in particular. All right. Payer pressures from Medicare and Medicaid, demand pressures because of growing uninsured, and certainly competitive market pressures. Thank you. Two of them here. All right. So that's another reason that we're very interested in this, and quite frankly, when you look at the numbers, you can see there's been a lot of safety net hospital change over time. In particular, for our study, we're looking at the period 1990 to the early 2000s. Why are we looking at that? Because we're using census data. We're trying to really measure the demographics of communities very well for a lot of the multivariate work we're going to do. All right. And what we see is that there's about 120 safety net hospitals that closed, using the definition developed by Daryl Gaskin to identify those institutions initially. And about 17% experienced an ownership change where we think it might be affecting their mission. All right. And I give you an example here because sometimes people look at these numbers and say, well, they look kind of small. But when you look locally at some of these institutions, for example, Milwaukee County Hospital that closed in Wisconsin, you can see that it really had it could have a potentially large effect in its community. The focus of our study, again, we're looking at five states. Why these five? Because they have the data we need. That's pure. If there were 20 states that had the data we need, needed, we'd be looking at 20 states. But these five states have all the data that we need. We're looking at state inpatient discharge data. That's our primary source of data. Again, we're looking at the 90s, early 90s to 2000, because we're trying to measure the characteristics of communities in small areas. We're looking at distance. That's an important factor. So we're looking at how close patients are to these safety net institutions, primarily interested in the uninsured, but we're also going to look at the Medicaid population. And we look at three population groups, non-Hispanic white, non-Hispanic black, and Hispanic individuals. Just to give you a sense, this is what we see in our communities as far as change. You can see there's a great deal of variability. Florida, which we're most interested in, had about 38 safety net hospitals in our base year for that state, three closed and eight converted, again, with the potential that it could affect their safety net mission. Now, I mentioned we're looking at hospital discharge data, all right? So we're looking at patients that were admitted to hospital, all right? And we're looking in particular at the reasons for admission. And we're using admissions as the basis for judging their access to health care. So for example, we're looking at ambulatory care sensitive conditions. These are hospitalizations that could potentially have been avoided if adequate primary or preventive care was in place. And I give you some examples there. We're also looking at specialty services that require high-tech hospital services and specialty physician involvement. And we're looking at marker conditions. Why are we looking at marker conditions? These aren't access sensitive, but in a sense, they provide our framework, a point of comparison, to look at ambulatory care sensitive conditions and also referral sensitive conditions. Right? If safety net hospitals are effective, they should be influencing the occurrence of these first two categories of service. All right. In particular, if it is the case that safety net hospitals are facilitating access to primary care, we should see a reduction in ambulatory care sensitive conditions relative to marker conditions. We should also see an increase in referral sensitive conditions if safety net institutions are facilitating access to specialty care. Potentially, these effects could be stronger for racial or ethnic minorities, especially if their access is particularly poor without the safety net institutions. Okay. Let me show you some of our early data. Again, this is just for Florida. This is our base year for Florida, which had to be 1992, given data availability. And what we have here is based on where patients were, uninsured patients are located, namely looking at bands, if you will, concentric bands around a safety net institution, we looked at the kinds of hospitalizations they had, not just to the safety net hospital, but to any hospital. Right? And what did we see? Well, you know, quite frankly, what we're seeing here is an increase within the non-Hispanic black population in the rate of these hospitalizations relative to marker conditions, which is consistent with our hypothesis. The farther away they are, it appears that they have less access to health, to the safety net, primary care services that may be available, so we're seeing more ambulatory care sensitive conditions. However, among uninsured whites and uninsured Hispanics in our base year, we're not seeing that relationship. Referral-sensitive conditions, we're seeing something that we did expect, that the farther away the patient is, all right, so as we go here, we're getting farther away. We're seeing a reduction in referral-sensitive conditions, all right? But I think the one thing that intrigued us was how small these steps are for white uninsured individuals, yet the drop for non-Hispanic black and for Hispanics was more substantial. These are the things that we're trying to study. We're trying to see, this is just unadjusted statistics, all right? And we're going to be doing multivariate analysis to try to understand why we're observing these phenomena. The other thing that interests us, and hopefully I'll have enough, few more minutes to cover this, we're really interested in some of the things we observe in Florida in terms of institutions that were leaving the marketplace. As we know, and Florida is consistent with this, safety net hospitals are located in poor neighborhoods with high rates of minority populations. But the one thing that fascinated us in Florida is that the locations of three hospitals that closed, safety net hospitals, were very striking in terms of their demographics. And here they are. And they were striking not only relative to the overall state, but to safety net hospitals generally. These are three hospitals that closed, right? So they're gone. Everglades Memorial Hospital, this is inland in Florida, in Pahokee, Florida. And you can see the profile there in terms of racial, ethnic composition and poverty. Deland Hospital and also Polk General. So these are three institutions that closed. And I think what struck us in particular was the high percentage of black in these communities. These are 2000 demographic statistics. We didn't have it for the base year. Couple things about these hospitals for Everglades. That's the one that has especially outstanding or concerning characteristics in terms of racial composition and poverty. Everglades Hospital closed. A hospital that was a safety net institution 10 miles away after the closure turned for-profit, right? So it went from public to for-profit. The nearest remaining safety net hospital for people in this community is 44 miles away, all right, in Palm Beach. So we're talking about some dramatic change that we expect in this community. For Fish Memorial, another one that's kind of interesting. 1 minute. Oh. Let me just show you the graphs quickly. Fish Memorial was acquired by a church-affiliated system, the Adventist system. There was a second public hospital in this community. One of them was closed, resulted in a reduction in capacity of about a third in that community in terms of the safety net. And I just want to flash these in front of you to show you where the original facility was located, which includes that cluster of a high, relatively high black population. The new facility is in the pink with very low, if any, minority population or black population. Here's the poverty statistics, right? And here's just a sense of what happened. This is something that we see happening across the country, not just in Florida. Hospitals, because of the need to remain financially viable, are cutting their losses short and closing facilities in places which they call poor payer mix and building new facilities in places with better payer mix. Of course, I can understand that from a strategic perspective. However, in doing this research now, the effects on these communities have to be substantial. And that's what we're trying to understand. I have no time left. Let me just flash. We have a lot of work to do. Everything I've presented here has been descriptive. We have some multivariate analysis we're doing. We're also doing some qualitative research. And I would appreciate any thoughts you have on what we're doing to help us as we proceed forward.
Thank you, Dr. Pizzoli. Very interesting work. Our next speaker in this session on funded research from National Cancer Institute this time, will be a presentation by Dr. Cleveland Shields, who is an assistant professor of child development and family studies at Purdue University. Dr. Shields' research focuses on psycho-oncology. He investigates physician-patient communication with cancer patients, including patient activation with breast cancer patients, and use of didactic models targeting middle-aged and older couples who are coping with cancer. And as I said, his presentation will include research that's been funded by NCI. Dr. Shields?
Move it forward, I just press this. Okay, I'm very happy to be here. I spent 19 years at the University of Rochester Medical School before moving on to Purdue University. And I just I didn't make a slide of acknowledgments, so I just want to do that quickly first. I want to acknowledge my two colleagues at University of Rochester, Dr. Ron Epstein and Dr. Kevin Fasella, with whom I worked on a lot of physician-patient communication research. And Kevin Fasella and I first worked up the idea of doing randomized controlled trials with or experimental designs with standardized patients. So what I'm going to mostly focus on today is sort of the methodology of using standardized patients. But first, I'll explain what they are. And I also want to acknowledge my research assistants at Purdue University who worked on these studies with me, Casey Coker and Shruthi Polson, who's now at the University of Colorado in Denver, and Jennifer Doyle. And I also want to acknowledge the enthusiastic support from Vicki Shavers, who thinks that I'm a very devious person in conducting this research. Thinks I would get arrested if I did any of this in my normal life. So what is a standardized patient? These are people who have been trained to portray a real patient with authenticity in content and affect. They present illness in a standardized way. Now, some of you may have never heard it. We refer to them as SPs. That's the only acronym I hope I'll ask you to remember during my talk. There's a long history of SPs in medical education starting in the 1960s. Most medical schools have a program of SPs to train medical students in interviewing and physical exams. So it's very common. Now, the advantage of using SPs rather than real patients is that SPs can be randomized to physicians by race, ethnicity, gender, or national origin. I heard somebody say earlier, well, you can't just, you know, make one patient be black and one patient be white. Well, sure you can, at least in the kind of research I do. The researcher has control over the type and context of the patient in the study. Visits can be unannounced, that is, physicians can consent to be in a study in which we send the SPs to the patients without announcing that they're coming that day, at that time. They know that sometime over the next 3 months they're going to get a visit from a standardized patient, but they don't know when. But SPs can't announce, you know, can't study the natural ongoing relationships with patients and how relationships change or develop over time. So standardization, how do we standardize these patients? Well, it starts with the research hypothesis. If you want to test whether African American patients are treated differently than white patients, you would choose AA, African American standardized patients, and white standardized patients to be randomly assigned to see physicians. And so SPs allow us to control for patient characteristics and are therefore helpful in answering questions about the physician characteristics. I wish that we could, I'd love to be able to give an IAT test to physicians before we send out these SPs, but that would just be alerting the physicians to what we want to know about them. So I haven't been able to figure out any way to do that without, you know, setting up the physicians, giving away our hypothesis. And then you have to design a scenario to test the hypothesis. We have to design the right scenario. Under what circumstances do you anticipate this differential treatment to happen? Of course, that's already been talked about some today. What kinds of differential treatment do you expect? How can you control for external factors so that your findings are representative of actual differential treatment? So you have to write an illness scenario. And, you know, many times we're talking about stuff that Michelle Van Ren in particular has talked about, or many others have talked about today, you know, under situations of cognitive stress, the implicit bias comes to the fore rather than us being able to filter this and being able to keep these things under control. And so at this time, our implicit bias has come forward and we make decisions or we act on stereotypes that we might not otherwise act on. So we may, in a busy oncology practice, someone may discriminate where they might not normally discriminate. So we create SPs with the right background in terms of our illness scenario. We may create them with an illness scenario, but the story has to be believable. It must be within the right range that the MD would expect to see within his or her office. So I'm going to We're in a second, I'm going to make up a scenario that's a little different than our own, because I'm not prepared to share the real results of our own study at this point. But we found it helpful to specify certain personality characteristics that would both increase authenticity and decrease the possibility of detection. Our patient characteristics in our study included such things as low level of education, slightly depressed, small family, middle SES, and recently relocated. These helped the SP to assume the role of a patient who is not very educated about his own health. Our SPs were male. And as a backup plan, the SP acted uninformed if he did not know how to answer a question that the physician put to him. So let's just take the problem of colon cancer, which was not the problem in my own study. We know that the incidence of colon cancer is higher for AA than white, for African Americans. So African American patients were less likely, according to the literature, to obtain surgical resection than white patients. White patients are still more likely to die. That must be backwards. That must be in African Americans. I must have typed that wrong, unless somebody knows the literature better than me. The researcher has to think about the mechanism that might drive this disparity within the MD patient encounter. Suppose your hypothesis is that African American patients who have high education and professional status will be treated the same as white patients. What kind of study could you design using SPs to test such a hypothesis? You could randomize African American and white patients, each coached to be highly educated professional or high school or less educated working class patient. In addition, you want to see if they are treated the same as all whites or only the same as educated or professional whites. Thus, your question could become, is SES driving the disparity or is race driving this disparity? And this has already been talked about quite a bit this morning. So you may end up with a study design that looks something like this, a randomized block design, where the order of African American or white is randomized in the order of now I suddenly don't remember what CP, but that's the education and professional status is randomized. So with content experts, you would write out an entire script. I mean, the actors, the people who would be your standardized patients, you'd write out an entire script for them of what they would say about any kind of question the physician might ask them. And they would be responsible to memorize virtually that entire script. And They wouldn't so much go in and just spew that script out. They would be prepared, whatever type of question the physician asked them, they would be prepared with an answer for that. And they would need a background family history, a work history, and in our case, and I would suggest this for pretty much any medical scenario, if you're studying cancer, that they would come in with a medical, it'd be sent in advance, say, from some other part of the country, where you'd have to have some reason they're coming there to be treated for cancer. That's what I work with. They would have a complete medical record to convince the MD that they're seeing, or the DO, that they have cancer. So we had with the oncologist that was part of my study, she had written up a complete medical record, complete with radiation reports, all kinds of stuff that, being a PhD, I didn't understand. But we convinced all our docs, pretty much, that this patient sitting in front of them had cancer and was sick and had end-stage cancer. And it was just, they were just convinced of it. They didn't, they wanted to send them off for a PET scan, right? Most of them were calling up and calling the radiation oncologist, can you get this guy in? Wanted to send them for more tests right then, that day. So we thought we did a pretty good job of fooling them. Yes, we are devious. So where do you find these people if you're going to do this kind of research? Where do you find these people to go on this trip with you to do SP studies? Well, medical school settings, and I have, oh, okay, thanks. Medical schools have extensive programs in using standardized patients for education. So you could hire from their cadre of SPs used for teaching. However, many of them are not used to the rigors. We started out doing this in my study, not used to the rigors of research where they have to really stick to a role at 95% accuracy. So you really have to do a lot of training with them to stick strictly to a role. We ended up actually, one of our original SPs got sick with cancer himself and had to drop out of the study. So we had to rehire a whole new cadre of SPs, and we ended up hiring people who had done community theater. And the first guy we hired, he came back to the second session, had memorized the entire role, and I said, ooh, this is the way to go. And so we ended up hiring two people who worked in community theater, and they did a fantastic job. They're also very good at ad-libbing, because they're used to doing, you know, a lot of improvisation and things. And the only thing is you have to rein them in a little bit so they don't go too far with that sometimes. And one fellow had a lot of medical problems. He always managed to bring up a few of those during some of his visits. So you got to watch for that, too. You have to keep them on task. Yes, I know you've got all these, can't remember what it's called, and I had these bony deposits from certain kind of arthritis he had, and I had to keep him from bringing those up in all of his medical sessions. He's always looking for a little free medical advice. Gouty arthritis, that's what he had. We also paid a different rate for training and for actual performance time. I think we paid them $12 an hour for training and $16 an hour when they went out on a visit. But all these different things, and we had a meeting every week where they came back in. We would have listened to the visits, rated them for adherence to the role, and then we would discuss that. And this is a big part of their training. And they also needed a lot of time to process the visit because it was a big deal. You know, that what they went through was quite an ordeal for them. You know, we somehow managed to keep them completely blind to what the whole purpose of the project was. Recruiting physicians for the study was probably the biggest job in the whole study. I really had to do a lot of first-class schmoozing in order to make this happen, which is something I've been told I'm good at. So I spent a lot of time when I first arrived in Indiana, because I moved to Indiana with this grant, as I immediately started getting to everybody. Anyways, I made a lot of friends at the IU Cancer Center, and I got some of the leading oncologists there to write letters to everybody they knew in the state, telling them that this was a good idea to participate in my study. I met a lot of them. I went to an ASCO review meeting, met a lot of oncologists face-to-face. And we also, for this pilot study, we recruited both oncologists and family physicians, just because we knew there weren't enough oncologists for the purpose of this study who we thought we could recruit in Indiana just for the purpose of this study. So, we ended up contacting 26 oncologists and consented 22 of them, which is a pretty remarkable rate. But basically, those who got a letter from this sort of chief oncologist at IU, that was like gold, having that letter from that guy. So those are the kind of things that took to do the recruiting. The family physicians recruited through an email list, and so we sent 150 different family docs emails, and that was much more passive recruiting, so we got 28 responses. So that was only a recruiting rate of 14%. So we trained the SPs they read the script, we encouraged them to ask questions, we did a tremendous amount of role playing. I tried to role play, I'm a therapist, I tried to role play a really gruff, you know, sort of quote unquote bad doctor, and I was told I sucked at that. We had to have other people play the bad doctor stuff, you know, gruff, somebody cut them off. But we did a lot of role playing, critiquing their own performances, but we did a lot of role playing before they went out in the field. During the training, their performances were critiqued and coded for adherence to the role, and that was very important to do. And we also had to pace their performances, we had to make sure their affect was right. But the SPs really got into this, and they really, since they were our people were actors, they really enjoyed, you know, really working it up, hamming it up for the role. How much time do I have? I'm about it. 5 minutes? Okay. When we consented the physicians, we had to get a confederate in their office, somebody, a nurse. Most of the physicians were also involved in a research network in the state of Indiana called the Hoosier Oncology Group, or affectionately known as the HOG. This is only in Indiana. This person was the money penny to our 007, who helped us arrange all the visits to the standardized patient to their office. So all future correspondence with the office was through the Confederate, and we scheduled the visits to the Confederate through the Confederate. And the Confederate helped us deal with all the medical records, insurance. We sent the medical record ahead to the office through the Confederate. These are a few other things we did to make sure the ruse held. We had fake insurance cards. We had 4 extra cell phones, for one for the SP's child, one for the previous physician. These all had the one for the previous physician. We managed to get a cell phone with a different state's error code. We had one for the insurance company and one for the patient. So many of these had, we found a way to, you know, get cell phones with different area codes. We would do anything to make them believe that we were for real. And these phones rang off the hook right after the visits, usually. So we made up packets for the SPs before they went on visits with all these things. The SPs carried 2 hidden recorders, digital recorders, in their pockets. We insisted they carry 2. We had one person who didn't think 2 was necessary. And of course, we went out and the one failed, so we lost data from that. So we were always prepared. And we came to the conclusion we only scheduled visits when the Confederate was in the office, because we did have one person go to an office and the Confederate wasn't there, and he got grilled about his insurance, and they thought we were trying to commit insurance fraud. Somehow or other, he acted incensed, and did, because he was an actor, and he managed to get by. So Confederate, sometimes SPs were in the office for up to 2 hours before they actually saw the physician and got out. Our SPs were detected less than 15% of the time. SP has to stay enrolled the whole time. They bring the materials and the recorders back to the office that day or the next. We transfer the recorders, stuff to the computers in our office, and we code stuff immediately, as quickly as we can. We code it for patient-centered care, voice tone. We called it for in our case, we coded it for prognosis communication, pain communication, and feedback from our Confederates suggested that they really enjoyed their role. We paid them in addition to the physician, and SPs needed a lot of support, but it was a lot of fun. And somehow or other, we managed to keep the SPs naive to the hypotheses of our study. But it's kind of a fun way to do research. It requires a lot of flexibility and patience, but we really had a lot of fun doing it. So that's the end.
We'll now open for questions, comments. Are we in the post-lunch holdrums?
I know you said that they consented, that the RAs consented, the physicians, but what I might have missed this. What exactly did you tell them that the study was about? And then was there any pushback by the physicians? Did they ever feel that they were duped or any? Any negative consequences?
We told them that it was a deception study. So we would tell them we weren't telling them everything, and that we'd be sending in that second consent when the study was over. So when I get back on Wednesday, we'll be sending out the second consent. And the only negative, if there was a negative thing, a number of times, we sent a fax 3 weeks after the visit to tell them that they had seen the SP 3 weeks ago and asked them if they had any memory of that and if they realized it at the time. We had less than 14% what we call prompted suspicion. But we had a number of cases where we had to let them know sooner because the physician was agitated that the patient hadn't come back or followed up. because they were so worried about them, which my oncologist colleague on the study, she said, oh, that's so wonderful. They're such good doctors. So we had a number of them. We had to let them know early just because they were so worried about the patient, that their Confederates would call us and say, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Dr. X is all worried and upset.
I had a question for Dr. Basoli. One question I had was whether your study would make sense to stratify by disorder, because one of the concerns I have is that depending on the in that community, what that safety net hospital does well,
right,
you might get very different findings. So I thought, like, for example, we're finding that safety nets make a big difference for certain Latino groups for mental disorders. But, you know, it might be that for other things, it might not make any sense to go to the safety net because they don't have resources. So I wonder how you're taking that into account.
Yeah, we do have the ability to look at particular kinds of ambulatory care sensitive hospitalizations or referral sensitive conditions. But the problem we face is our data is specifically hospitalizations. So they get admitted. I would love to have the data, the opportunity to try to do this for a broader range of services, such as what you've described. But even with that in mind, we are able to look at groups of ambulatory care-sensitive conditions, which we're planning to do, because some of them are more relevant, for example, for children versus adults versus the elderly. So we are able to do that. But we don't have the kind of data, first, to look within groups of the Latino or the African-American population. We don't have that kind of dispersion, that kind of information and the discharge data. And again, we are just looking at hospital admissions, so we're limited in that regard.
I have a question about the standardized patients. So, this, of course, very much appeals to the experimental social psychologist in me. So when you are manipulating something between patients, such as SES or, say, race, you know, if you do that, how many SPs do you need per condition, and do you just send one to each physician, or do you send multiple visits to get a more general sense of how they're treating patients of that type?
Well, there's been a number, for instance, the next study I'm planning to send to, there's a number of studies, for instance, have been studies of prescription, you know, like antidepressant prescribing by Rich Kravitz, and I was one of those studies, and they sent two patients in, one, and they were looking at whether they prescribed appropriately or not appropriately, and they sent in a patient with adjustment disorder versus clearly depression. And they found that if they requested the medication, they would more likely get it. And they were looking at the effect of advertising on this. And so the effect of advertising was very strong. And then in a study I was part of, they looked at whether better communication would mitigate the effect of advertising, and it did. So it sort of showed that good interviewing techniques would sort of mitigate the effect of advertising, so direct-to-consumer advertising. So if that was a within-patient study or within-person, within-subject study. So it sort of depends on just exactly what your design is. So I think you can do two visits. I think it'd be a little harder to do three visits and, you know, hide that, you know, keep it actually, you know, on, you know, the physician wouldn't realize, oh, I'm seeing another SP.
Could you address when you're going to have results? I know Dr. Shields, you were talking about today you really couldn't present as much in terms of specific results, and Dr. Basoli, so that we can we'll know when to look forward to seeing this published. And so,
well, as I presented today, we just looked at Florida for the purposes of this presentation. We already have the analysis, similar analysis going underway for the five states, and also looking at urban and rural environments, and we are beginning our multivariate work. In terms of when we hope to have hard results, we certainly want to get some hard results this fall. When will the publications come? Well, that takes time, but we're hoping that we can begin to present some of the multivariate analysis sometime next summer, certainly, with papers to follow shortly thereafter.
And Dr. Shields?
Well, the differences by race, I'm probably going to just put them in the R01 application and not, mostly because it's sort of pilot data and there's so many confounds that I don't want to actually publish that. Plus, I'm afraid it'll contaminate the subject pool that I'm going after for the R01. But I have some other stuff that I can publish in the meantime.
And I ask that because, as you know, with this program announcement, we're really trying to encourage investigators to be submitting applications and hopefully have, you know, successes like yourselves in terms of funding. So it's nice to see what the full cycle is here of your funding. So anything else? If not, then we'll draw a close to this session. And thank you again for Gloria and Cleveland's presentations this afternoon. We'll now go on to the next. Thank you.